This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
By recognizing the shadow government of unknown opposition figures, the U.S. government, in terms of U.S. law, actually set the pretext for the looting of billions of dollars worth of Venezuela's internationally stored financial assets.
The U.S. appointment of Juan Guaido as president of Venezuela may have seemed like a joke, but it enabled U.S. corporations to seize many of that country's transnational assets.
When we see the Congolese government bringing a suit against Apple, we have to take it with a grain of salt. It may be that they're just playing to the current environment and the populist sentiment that's out there among the masses.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo is suing tech giant Apple for dealing in quote-unquote blood minerals.
Fuera! 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 Fuera, Milei! Fuera!
Stop the fascists, stop Milei. We don't want him in the United States, and the people of Argentina don't want him either. People of Argentina are organizing against him all over the country.
Silicon Valley and San Francisco Bay Area communities protest the visit of Argentinian President Javier Milei. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In 2019, the U.S. declared the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro illegitimate and named Juan Guaido, a minor opposition politician, its rightful president. I spoke to Anya Parampil, Gray Zone contributor and author of Corporate Coup, Venezuela and the End of U.S. Empire, about the consequences. Anya, I found four storylines in your book, one about the corporate coup, another about the brutal sanctions likened to a medieval siege, a third about failed humanitarian intervention, and the last about the shift in the geopolitical order that all this contributed to. So can we start with the first, the corporate coup?
Thanks for having me, Anne. What I hope to explain with this book is while people may be familiar with the failure of the Trump administration's attempted coup in Venezuela, the fact that it on the surface appears absurd and everyone knows that it resulted in no material change on the ground, there was actually a very significant corporate coup. And that's because while it didn't change the political situation in Venezuela itself, by recognizing the shadow government of unknown opposition figures, the U.S. government, in terms of U.S. law, actually set the pretext for the looting of billions of dollars worth of Venezuela's internationally stored financial assets. And so just for one example of how this works, Carlos Vecchio, the so-called ambassador representing this coup government in the United States, I found through my research was not just some run-of-the-mill political apparatchik. He was actually the lead attorney fighting Venezuela's government on behalf of ExxonMobil during the early years of the revolution in Venezuela when they were working to nationalize their oil wealth. Vecchio was actually already then a functionary of the private oil industry and then began fighting the Venezuelan government and Venezuelan courts and left the country eventually after he participated in the violent Guarimba riots of 2015, which were these U.S.-backed protests in the street that resulted in street barricades and a complete shutdown of the country's economy. It was like a terrorist, really, uprising, masked individuals that shut down the country for weeks. And Vecchio had been at the front line of that movement. He'd also, for years, not only worked as a lawyer for Exxon, but led several NGOs and civil society groups that were funded by the United States for opposition to Venezuela's government in the streets, and hopefully their goal was, of course, to overthrow the government. And so he comes in and claims to be representing the Venezuelan people in the eyes of the U.S. government. This enabled him and his colleagues to actually seize billions of dollars worth of Venezuela's assets in the United States, including Sitco Petroleum, which is a major company, which includes not only gas stations, but oil pipelines and oil refineries in the United States. And following the recognition of Guaido's coup, again, although no change in government happened on the ground in Caracas, the U.S. government immediately went in, seized not only Citgo, but Venezuelan bank accounts in the United States, and then U.S. allies as well, including the United Kingdom, followed suit. So London ended up seizing $2 billion worth of Venezuelan gold, which is now valued at even higher because the price of gold keeps rising. But the UK, even though Venezuela under Maduro had actually requested to repatriate that gold that was stored in London in 2018, months later, London recognized the shadow government in Venezuela and then gave itself the excuse to not repatriate the gold, to deny the request and say, oh, well, we don't actually know who controls the government in Venezuela, so we get to keep this gold in our own vault. It was a very tricky, unprecedented hybrid coup attempt that I want people to understand did succeed in many ways. And it should be understood, really, as a form of modern-day piracy and a truly criminal act against the people of Venezuela.
So Juan Guaido is remembered as a clown, but these corporations are laughing all the way to the bank.
Exactly.
Okay, now, can you explain the U.S. sanctions regime likened to a medieval siege?
Yes, something I document is the continuity between the U.S. administrations and various parties in targeting Venezuela with a hybrid war. And there are really four prongs in this hybrid war. I expose the propaganda war that we know through media, the diplomatic war where the U.S. used tricks at the OAS and the UN to try and force this shadow government on its international partners and on the international community, the covert dirty war in the form of guerrilla groups or the failed mercenary Bay of Piglets invasion people may be familiar with. But then what I spend the most time on is the economic war, because this is really the most significant. And it is a blueprint that applies not only to Venezuela, but other targeted countries of U.S. Transatlantic Empire. So we're talking about Russia, Iran. These are all, this is a playbook that is really rolled out against all these countries. And when I document the economic war on Venezuela, I show it really began in 2015 when the Obama administration decided to classify Venezuela as a national security threat to the United States without really providing any evidence or explanation as to why it made that decision. But immediately, that sent a message to international creditors that Venezuela is a country that could be going to war with the United States shortly. And so virtually overnight, prices of shipping to Venezuela, basic goods, this is a country that's highly independent on imports because for 100 years it's been a leading oil producer. The U.S. and the U.K. and the West were happy to provide Venezuela with all the toilet paper and basic supplies, goods that it needed, so that it never had to develop a domestic production capacity as long as it gave oil to the international market the way London and Washington liked. Well, when Venezuela decided to do things its own way and keep some of that wealth for itself, the U.S. and London thought that they could close off imports by first raising the price through this national security declaration and then rolling out several other sanctions that targeted anybody who did business with Venezuelan entities, including the Trump administration ultimately even went so far as to say that foreign companies or third-party companies that tried to do business with Venezuela on their own, the U.S. will also come in and try to prosecute, which they did. And so what I show, and it's not just my opinion, I use multiple studies and also an investigation conducted by U.N. Special Rapporteur Alfred Dzaias, who actually visited Venezuela. He determined that sanctions in the country amounted to a modern-day medieval siege. But opposition economists as well, Francisco Rodriguez is someone that I introduce in the book as this, you know, dedicated Maduro critic. He's no fan of Maduro or Chavismo. But from the United States, where he's a highly respected academic and economist, he has published several studies. Francisco Rodriguez conducted his own research to find that U.S. sanctions he determined amounted to a surgical strike on Venezuela's oil industry. And with his own time data analysis, he came up with what he called a smoking gun, demonstrating that U.S. sanctions were the primary contributing factor to Venezuela's economic decline. This was a decline that led to 40,000 excess deaths, according to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a D.C.-based think tank that conducted that study in 2019. So there's a variety of reports that I cite and synthesize in order to truly make the case that it is Washington's aggressive economic warfare policy that drove the downturn in Venezuelan living standards and ultimately, then you could say, contributed to the migrant crisis we're even experiencing today.
And those sanctions are still in place, right?
Yes. The Biden administration did issue a small waiver to Chevron so it could begin bringing in some Venezuelan oil, but that was simply just to counteract the Biden administration's own decision to unleash an embargo against Russian oil in 2021. So economic aggression all around.
Okay, now can you tell us the story of the failed humanitarian intervention?
This was a wild chapter in the Venezuela coup saga because it was kind of unconventional. Right following the recognition, the U.S.'s recognition of Guaido, it attempted to pretty much unleash a military invasion on Venezuela, but behind the guise of a humanitarian aid convoy. And that was pretty dangerous. Basically, the United States announced that it was shipping tons of humanitarian supplies that were needed in Venezuela in from Colombia. And they flew on military planes all of this aid and were gathering there and with USAID and in their trucks for several weeks, kind of building up to this date at the end of February 2019 when the U.S. declared it was going to, without the permission of the Venezuelan government, just drive the aid across the border. And of course, that would ultimately have to be done with the U.S. military. And so I was in Venezuela at the time. It was a really tense moment because Venezuelans, you know, I spoke to one journalist who was crying at the time. She was like, I saw what the U.S. did to Libya, to Syria, to Iraq, and now I'm worried it will be my country next. So it was a really terrifying time. And Venezuela was adamant that they would not allow any of this U.S. military equipment or aid to pass through. And of course, pointed out the fact that Elliot Abrams was working as the Trump Venezuela envoy at the time. He'd previously been convicted for his role in Iran-Contra, where he'd overseen the plot to ship weapons to the Nicaraguan Contras under the guise of humanitarian aid. That was his method back in the 1980s. And so to have this figure crafting U.S.-Venezuela policy at the time sent a message to the Venezuelans that they should be a little bit frightened of any assistance from Washington. But ultimately, despite the fact that, you know, billionaire Richard Branson hosted this giant concert on the border there to kind of create a cultural component to the war on Venezuela and hype it up, the invasion failed because the Venezuelan military remained united, defended the border. And I think that was the true test that the U.S. was playing at that time. They wanted to see that if they made this threat, they thought, okay, a bunch of Venezuelan soldiers will defect, their military will start to panic, and they'll be in a free fall, and it'll just spur this regime change that was the ultimate goal. But because not enough soldiers defected, and because they stayed and doubled down in defense of their country's sovereignty, no aid could get across the border, and what ended up happening was a bunch of masked thugs, hooligans, on the Colombian side of the border set fire to the aid and tried to blame it on Maduro's government. They tried to say, oh, Maduro and the Venezuelans, they don't want to accept the aid, but that's not good enough for them. They want to burn it to the ground too. Well, we at the Gray Zone, my husband, my partner at the time, Max Blumenthal, was able to document pretty thoroughly that it was these masked individuals, youth on the Colombian side who were responsible for setting the convoy on fire. And then several weeks later, the New York Times actually confirmed his reporting and corrected the record, saying, no, it wasn't Venezuela's government that was responsible for this fiasco. It was all individuals on the other side of the border. And it was just basically, it was a last ditch effort to embarrass the Venezuelan government after the invasion itself failed to materialize.
Okay, now finally, can you explain the geopolitical shifts that all of this contributed to?
Yeah, ultimately, as I mentioned, this tactic of hybrid warfare, especially economic warfare, is not something limited to Venezuela. It is a script that we have seen play out regarding a number of countries. In fact, I cite statistics that the deputy Russian foreign minister shared with me during an interview in the summer of 2019. And he said, according to his own government's research, that a third of the world's population currently live under some form of U.S. or Western economic sanction. And we thought for a long time that if we cut off the developing world from our financial system in order to force them into this zero-sum arrangement that we've kind of established since the end of World War II, that they would just become so weak that they wouldn't be able to import the goods they need, they wouldn't be able to access the dollars they needed, and they would fall. But what happened is we got far too cocky, in my opinion, targeted countries that are way more powerful than we truly realize because they have so many natural resources and for the first time can actually trade amongst themselves. It's no longer the case that the West and the United States are the major consumers of oil. Now we have Russia and China in the picture, and you're not going to be able to, as a U.S. official, convince the Chinese or the Indians that they can't buy oil from Venezuela or that they can't buy oil from Russia. And that's exactly what has happened. The U.S. sanctions have failed because the rest of the world is in a position to actually counteract them with their own sovereign trade. And that's what's happened in the case of Venezuela. I write about how U.S. sanctions forced Venezuela to forge strong relationships with countries that it had never really been in their orbit before, including Turkey and Iran. Turkey is a country that provides food, dried pasta and chocolate and oil, clean oil to Venezuela. And is even Turkish products are included in the monthly CLAP shipments that are part of the government's effort to respond to sanctions. They actually send out a box of subsidized food and household products to millions of families on a monthly basis. Turkish products appear in those boxes. I've actually been in people's houses when they receive products from Turkey from the Venezuelan government in that way. And so what U.S. warfare, financial warfare has done is created this force, all of these other countries to create a new world, and it's rising now. And we in the United States have not fully come to terms with this, but what I do try to say in the book is that there is a future for the United States if we decide to give up on this zero-sum empire that we've committed ourselves to for the past several decades, and that actually, if we decide to approach the world as a normal country that wants to make agreements based on mutually beneficial arrangements and respect for sovereignty and political dependence, that we would actually be much better off, because the corporate coup, honestly, is not just one that has targeted Venezuela. The financial and corporate elite who are responsible for that policy are also the people that are responsible for the lack of services and suffering and total decline of this country domestically as well. So I feel in some ways that we need to reclaim our sovereignty here in the United States from those elements. And then we'd be much better off, because really in 2024, I think their time is up. This corporate financial shadowy network that has existed in the background for so long can no longer maintain its grip on all of us, because the world truly has evolved beyond them.
Is there something you'd like to say about the fate of the dollar in all of this?
Well, we've kind of shot ourselves in the foot, again, by limiting everybody's access to dollars and assuming that that was going to lead to their collapse. All it did was force countries to begin trading in their own currencies, strengthening their own currencies, and realizing that they can trade and live life without us. It's quite remarkable, but I think it's a sign of overall human evolution, and we in the United States will be better off the sooner we kind of just accept reality.
That was Anya Parampil, Gray Zone contributor and author of Corporate Coup, Venezuela and the End of U.S. Empire, which is available in paperback and ebook formats from Orr Books at orrbooks.com.
Todos los solos, juntos debemos caminar, no estamos solos. No debemos acompañar, hija de Ayala. Nunca nadie nos parará, hijo de calle. Nadie nunca nos detendrá, todos los solos. Juntos debemos caminar, no estamos solos. No debemos acompañar, hija de Ayala. Nunca nadie nos parará, hijo de calle. Nadie nunca nos detendrá.
Estoy solo, solo del lado de la gente nací solo. Porque a mamá le dio la gana, yo soy solo. Un guerrillero caribe, moriré solo. Si a mi precio pueden llenar, estoy solo. Aquí parado junto a todo, hablando solo. De lo que tengo que contar, espero solo. Que nunca más se duerma el pueblo, mire solo. Cuando pare, paran, pam, pam.
Todos solos, juntos debemos caminar, no estamos solos. No debemos acompañar, hija de Ayala. Nunca nadie nos parará, hijo de calle. Nadie nunca.
That was Solos by Bitwaya. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Next, J.R. Valre of Block Report Radio spoke to Maurice Carney, the executive director of Friends of the Congo, about the lawsuit that the Democratic Republic of the Congo is filing against one of the world's biggest corporations, Apple, for dealing in blood minerals. They also spoke about how key Israelis have played a role in the Congolese genocide, which has claimed millions of lives.
With the Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, it's experienced a 25-plus year, quarter-century war of aggression and plunder by U.S. allies, primarily the Rwandan government, led by Paul Kagame, and the Ugandan government, led by Yoweri Museveni. Both countries invaded the Congo twice, in 1996 and then again in 1998. There was a peace deal that was established and arrived at in 2002, but both countries continue to wage a war of aggression and plunder against the Congolese people with the full backing of the United States. When I say the backing of the United States, I'm talking about military training, provisions of military equipment, financing, intelligence, you name it. And when there's an attempt by international bodies to hold these governments to account for the war crimes, crimes against humanity that they've committed, and even possibly genocide in the Congo, the United States run interference, diplomatic and political interference, so that neither Paul Kagame nor Yoweri Museveni brought to justice to account for the crimes they've committed in the Congo. So what both countries have done is support militia groups in the east of the Congo since 2002, since the peace agreement. And those militia groups displace communities, and they displace local communities where you find riches, mineral riches, like coltan, for example, or tin, or gold, or wolframite. And those mineral riches are then shipped across the border from Congo into Rwanda, and then they're sold to the international market. And that's where the Congolese government is accusing the companies like Apple for purchasing minerals from Rwanda that's tainted by the blood of Congolese people who have been displaced, whose women have been raped, or children have been inscripted into militia groups. So that's the source of the case that the Congolese government is bringing against companies like Apple. The government itself is part of the problem. The larger structural problem, JR, is this capitalist system that's in place. And I put the emphasis on capitalism and system because there are players within it. And the elites on the African continent, in this case we're talking about the elites in Congo, the elites in Rwanda, the elites in Uganda, they're all connected to the international finance system where they serve those interests. They serve those foreign interests to the detriment and at the expense of the people. So the Congolese government is also part of this system, the local elites, people call them compradors, who work against the interests of the oppressed masses, of the working class. So when we see the Congolese government bringing a suit against Apple, we have to take it with a grain of salt. It may be that they're just playing to the current environment and the popular sentiment that's out there among the masses. Because remember, there was an attorney in Washington, D.C., by the name of Terry Collinsworth, who works with international rights advocates. He brought a suit against 5 major tech companies, against Apple, against Tesla, against Google, against Dell, and against Microsoft. And that case had been in the courts for about 5 years. And while that case was in the court for 5 years, the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeal just ruled in favor of those tech companies. The suit was brought on behalf of 16 Congolese plaintiffs, children who were working in mines. The essence of the suit was that these companies were sourcing minerals from the Congo that was tainted by child labor. And the court, in a 3-0 decision, said, well, the plaintiffs had a case, they had a cause, they had standing. But what they didn't do was pursue or demonstrate that these companies that they were suing were in a venture with companies in the Congo that were using child labor. Even though Tesla is in a venture with a company called Glencore that is securing minerals from the Congo, but that venture that Tesla went into with Glencore came after the suit was initiated in 2019. So I mention this because this suit was in the process in the courts for 5 years. And the suit was against 5 major tech companies on behalf of Congolese children. And we didn't see the Congolese government rush to the side of the attorney or express any sentiment in support of the suit whatsoever. So we look at this foray on the part of the Congolese government, a sovereign government suing a company, you know, we look at it skeptically.
Can you talk a little bit about the recent assassination and coup attempt that has taken place in the Congo? Can you tell us a little bit about what are the people saying about what's really going on?
Yeah, May 19th, actually, on Malcolm's birthday, I had a gentleman by the name of Christian Malanga, who is a Congolese opposition figure. He was at one point in the Congolese military. He lived in Utah, and he heads up a movement called the New Zaire Movement, where he's the president of the New Zaire Movement, and he's the organizer of the United Congolese Party, the UCP. And he led this attack, reluctant to call it a coup, because just the nature of it. He led an attack against the presidential palace, the office where the president works at 4 a.m. or something like that. He had some soldiers with him, folks from the U.S. He brought his son with him, his 21-year-old son, to be a part of the attack. He streamed it live on Facebook, which made it seem more like a reality TV undertaking than any kind of a serious attempt for regime change of government in the Congo. So he went into the presidential palace or the president's office. The president doesn't stay there. The president stays somewhere else, right in the middle of a military camp. And on his way, they attacked some homes, the home of Vita Kamerhe, who was to be nominated, voted on to be the president of the assembly in the parliament. They're also considering attacking the prime minister's office and the minister of defense. I mean, prime minister's home and the minister of defense home, but not entirely clear whether or not to do that. But in any case, the thing about it is that if you follow the gentleman, Christian Malanga, he's been around for a number of years in the diaspora, talked about taking over as president in the Congo with the New Zaire movement. He is at a capitalist program where he talked about taking over and privatizing much of the country and creating a space for entrepreneurs. And his symbol was the Zaire flag. Zaire was what the U.S. installed and maintained dictator Joseph Désiré Mobutu renamed the Congo in the early 1970s. And when Mobutu was overthrown on May 17th, 1997, the Congo regained its name. Zaire was no more. And interestingly enough, not only did Christian Malanga use the Zaire flag as a symbol, his United Congolese Party was founded around the same time, around the same date, 2017 or so, but around May 17th which is symbolic because that's when Mobutu was overthrown. And then his attack was around that date as well, just 2 days after May 17th, May 19th. So the attack itself, it didn't threaten anything. It didn't appear to be serious. It didn't look like it was well-organized. It didn't look like it had the backing of anyone in the Congolese military or anyone in the Congolese political class, even though there may be one or two individuals that are being pointed at as supporting him. But if they were supporting him, they evidently didn't go all the way through because he just didn't have any support. It was just him, his son, and maybe about 50 people. And that doesn't represent a credible threat for a coup, or even it doesn't meet the criteria of a serious coup attempt. Maybe described as such, but it was more of an attack where he went into the presidential palace, took down the Congolese flag, hoisted the Zaire flag, streamed on Facebook and calling on the president to step down. They didn't even make it near the national television station. That's where folks usually go when they're doing a coup and say, hey, we take it over and broadcast to the nation. So, you know, even on May 19th, there was a big concert that was planned later in the day, and the concert went on. People went to the stadium, filled it, and just went on. Life went on. Christian Malanga, unfortunately, he was shot and killed. And his son was captured along with some of the mercenaries that came with him. One of them apparently has some ties to Israel and Israeli intelligence. But overall, it was like a blip. You know, it didn't really register. A lot of people in Kinshasa, I don't even think they were aware that this of what was happening. It seems like people outside of the country knew more because they had better access to information around what was happening. But the best we can say, or the most we can say around it, is that, you know, there is dissatisfaction with the current leadership. I don't know if it rises to the level where they would support an attempt like Christian Malanga, like his attempt on May 19th. But overall, in the scope of things, it hasn't affected anything one way or the other. JR, what it may have done is to now give the president, Tshisekedi, license to go after people, to clamp down. You say, you know, use the coup or the attack as a rationale for going after youth leaders, going after opposition figures, basically closing the political space and saying we need more security. This guy was able to get into the president's palace. We need to clamp down more, especially with, you know, rumblings that he's trying to change the president. Tshisekedi's trying to change the constitution so that he can stay in power beyond the two terms that the constitution currently states and limits the president. So I think that's what we ought to be watching out for, what steps Tshisekedi is taking and whether or not he's going to weaponize this attack in order to clamp down on those who are rightfully resisting his government, rightfully calling his government out for not protecting the Congolese people, particularly in the east, that is occupied by forces that are backed by Rwanda. And we've seen this Tshisekedi incapable. Not only incapable, but appears to be unwilling, not have the political will to go to the east and protect the people there. So we just have to watch that closely. But as far as the attack by Christian Malanga is concerned, I think that it's virtually insignificant as it relates to the current political landscape in the Congo.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship that Israel has to the genocide that is happening in the Congo?
It's multifaceted. Israel's connection to the Congo, and it really comes in three categories. And we're not just talking about since the war started in 96, but even before then. One is business, all right, particularly diamonds, connection there. Two is arms dealing, right? And you can fold into arms dealing security. Let's say security and arms dealing. And three is intelligence. Right? So that's what Israel's presence, not only in Congo, but in Africa overall, you know, in post-colonial Africa. Like, for example, when Mobutu was installed by the Central Intelligence Agency in 1965, you see that he was matched with a gentleman by the name of Maurice Templesman. And Maurice Templesman was a major diamond dealer. And he was the go-to guy for Mobutu in terms of the trading of diamonds. Some of folks here in the U.S. may be familiar with Maurice Templesman. He was the consort of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, major funder of the Democratic Party. There's an excellent film that PBS ran a while back called The Diamond Empire. If you consult that, you get a sense of the role that Maurice Templeton played with Mobutu as being his outlet for getting diamonds out of the Congo and really capturing a major part of the diamond sector. Now, with Mobutu gone, we found another Israeli, Templeton is a U.S. Citizen. I don't know if he has Israeli citizenship, but he's of the Jewish faith. We found another gentleman, Dan Gertler, who came in and he provided funding to Laurent Desiré Kabila, who removed Mobutu so that, I don't know, he gave him a few million dollars or so to help him in his rebel movement. And in return, Gertler was given monopoly over the diamond sector in the Congo. He had fallen out somewhat with Kabila the father, but he befriended the son, Joseph Kabila, who took over from his father and Laurent Kabila in 2001 when his father was assassinated. And Joseph Kabila stayed in power for about 18 years, 2001 to 2018. And during that 18-year period that Joseph Kabila was tight with Dan Gertler, now Dan Gertler is the grandson of, I think it's called Moshe Schnetzer, who founded the Israeli Diamond Exchange. This is the grandson of the founder of the Israeli Diamond Exchange. And over that 18-year period, his relationship with Joseph Kabila, he was able to do several things. He was able to accumulate billions of dollars, right, in billions of U.S. dollars to actually become a billionaire, right? And I think he was valued at about $2.7 billion or something like that, according to Bloomberg. And not only did he have monopoly on the diamond sector, he was also offered up other sectors by Kabila. He was into copper and cobalt. He had brought in another Israeli businessman by the name of Benny Steinmetz, and they established a company called Nicanor. And Nicanor is a company that had concessions for copper and cobalt. And because of his connections to international finance markets, he was able to take Nicanor public on the London Stock Exchange, the alternative investment market. At the time, this was about 2007 or so, 2008. It was one of the largest valuations in the history of the alternative investment market, almost $2 billion, the concession. And this is important because you have two Israelis, Steinmetz and Gertler, have access to a mine, copper, cobalt mine in the Congo, and they didn't dig a hole, toss a pebble or anything. They just had the paper. And they were able to take that paper to the capital markets, in this case, London Stock Exchange, and they were able to go public and get a valuation of that concession that they owned in the Congo. And at the time, the valuation was more than the entire Congolese, or equivalent to the Congolese budget, annual budget. Right? And this is just a slice of the Congo. So it gives you a sense, one, of the wealth that's there, two, how the lack of leadership on the part of the Congolese, in this case, President Kabila, because why couldn't the Congolese government state company get that valuation on the international market? Why couldn't a progressive Congolese get that valuation on the international market?
Right.
Just like a slice of the Congo. Not even, it's just like a piece of the Congo. We're not even talking about anything substantial. So in any case, some of the folks you know who are listening, they should check out Benny Steinmetz. He was deeply involved in apartheid South Africa, deeply involved in mining deals in Guinea, which he was brought up on charges for corruption. I don't know if I think he was convicted even as a result of his activities in Guinea. But Gertler, accumulating all this wealth with Kabila over an 18-year period, and then he was so beyond the pale in his corruption that he was gone after several times by the U.S. And one is Gertler was working with a Wall Street hedge fund by the name of Och Zif, and they have since changed their name to Sculptor. And Och Zif was fined by the United States, by the U.S. Justice Department, for corrupt practices. They were basically establishing a slush fund where people like Gertler can take millions of dollars from the slush fund take those dollars, pass them on to Congolese officials like Kabila, and in return, Gertler would then get these concessions for pennies on the dollar. So the African elites, Congolese elites, would pocket the money that was coming from Otjes-Vif, where Gertler was the middleman, and they were getting access to Congo's riches, where the Congolese people, Congolese state, wouldn't benefit from, only individuals who were getting the payoff. So
right.
It was so blatant, so bad that the Justice Department fined Otjes-Vif, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for corrupt practices, which is important for us to understand, because we usually, when you talk about corruption in Africa, they're talking about African elites. They don't talk about the Wall Street hedge funds. They don't talk about the corporations in the United States that are on Wall Street and is, quote unquote, legitimate, right? So that case is indicative of the type of corruption that takes place on the part of the financial elites in the West, in this case in the United States, and the local elites in Africa, the compradors. In any case, Gertler was so beyond the pale that even the Department of Treasury in 2017, I believe, put him on a sanctions list for corrupt practices, for pilfering the Congolese resources. He pilfered about $1.7 billion or something like that, some outrageous figure in terms of the amount that he basically robbed from the Congolese state. Right. So those funds that he's accumulated, those gains that he's made, he repatriates that back to Israel. Those are used, we're told, to build settlements and all of that. So that's one way that Israel benefits.
That was J.R. Valery of Bloc Report Radio in conversation with Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo. For more information, visit freecongo.org. That was music by Staff Bendabalili. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Argentina's President Javier Milei has supported fascist measures in Argentina and rallied with right-wing and fascist parties around the world. He visited Silicon Valley last week at the invitation of the Corporate Bay Area Council. He visited Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg and OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, whom he wants to support his privatization and union busting in Argentina. Community and labor organizations called a protest against him and against the tech CEOs. Milei has also supported the Israeli Zionist regime.
Fuera!
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 Fuera! Fuera, Milei! Fuera!
Fuera!
We're here today to protest Javier Milei, who's here. And we're also condemning the Bay Area Council, which has invited Javier Milei, who's the president of Argentina, to their conference. And we have a great concern about Javier Milei, because what he's doing in Argentina is he's destroying people. He's privatizing the schools, he's privatizing public education, and he's also wants to put in laws. One law that he proposed was if you have more than three people, you have to have a government permit to have a meeting. So we think that that's part of a fascist movement. And he is, of course, greeted by people like Elon Musk and other billionaires who would like to have fascism. We call them techno-fascists. They want to use technology to make more money and also to get rid of workers, because AI, which they're supporting, will get rid of 300 million workers around the world. And this is a disaster for working people.
Just remembering with my friend Eduardo that it seems like yesterday, 1979, we were here in downtown San Jose protesting the crimes of the military dictatorship of Argentina. At the time, we had signs that said 5,000 disappeared people, hundreds of children that we don't know where they are. And we went to churches, we went to synagogues, we went everywhere. And we had a local group called the Committee for Freedom in Argentina. And here we are again. Don't we ever learn? The forces of oppression, the forces of darkness are very, very powerful. And they're having the day in Argentina again. But to the darkness comes and follows the light. And sooner than you expect, you will find the Argentinian people together again, putting themselves in the right movement for the right transformation that our country needs. I hope that we all are persistent in supporting the good cause of the Argentine people and the Latin American people. The struggles of every person in Latin America is our own struggle, and we embrace them all, and the only way out is doing it together. So, let's have hope, let's have persistence. They cannot win always. We have defeated them many times, and we will see a good day for all of us again.
Hi, I'm Wendy Greenfield from Jewish Voice for Peace, and I just want to mention that Israel and Argentina have a history of supporting each other, in particular when Argentina was under military dictatorship, and many countries around the world, including the United States, stopped providing arms to Argentina because of their terrible human rights record of what they were doing to so many people, disappearing people, torturing people, holding them captive in clandestine concentration camps. Israel continued to provide arms to Argentina during that time. And that's a very interesting thing to me because Israel and allies often say that one of the reasons we should support the Israeli government is because they help stop anti-Semitism in the world. And yet they were supporting one of the most anti-Semitic regimes in the past, you know, 50 years. That in Argentina, of the 30,000 disappeared people, the ones who were kidnapped by the paramilitary death squads and held in clandestine centers and tortured, of those people, about 11% were Jewish, while Jews were less than 1% of the population. And so there was obviously some feelings against Jews among the military, among the people in the dictatorship. And so in spite of that, Israel was supplying the arms. And so we say, hey, this is not a country that is really supporting Jews or any other oppressed people for that matter. And right now, when Israel is doing so much against the Palestinian people, it is for all of us, people around the world, to support them, whether we are Jewish or Palestinian or Muslim or Christian, whatever group that we identify with, we need to support the Palestinian people and make sure that the genocide stops, as well as supporting the Argentine people who are suffering.
Malay has canceled out. When he heard that we were going to be here, the brave Malay decided he didn't want to face the people. He's a coward, and he can't face the people here. He can meet privately with Musk and the billionaires, but he can't meet with the people here. What does that tell you about Malay? He's a fraud. He's a fraud, and he's a hypocrite. And he's involved in giving away the wealth of Argentina to the billionaires. The reason Musk likes him is because he's giving away Argentina to Musk and the billionaires. We're saying get rid of the billionaires. The wealth of Argentina belongs to the people of Argentina, not the billionaires. We need to stop this fascism. We need to stop the attacks on the Argentinian people. The Argentinian people have suffered enough. They don't need Malay, and they don't need other wannabe dictators. It's Zionists that he supports. And Zionism is based on colonialism. So we're here today to let Javier Milei know that he is opposed by people in the United States. They don't want to see fascism. Lisa Milo, she's a member of UPTI, rank and file member of UPTI University and professional technical employees. She also is a Chilean American who's been fighting the Pinochet supporters. And Milei actually is a supporter of Pinochet, and he would like to do in Argentina what they did in Chile. So welcome, Lisa.
Some people know already, you know, how Javier Milei's antics with chainsaw and what that meant, right? This chainsaw means he'd like to cut off the heads of his opposition. And he openly supported the generals of the military junta in Argentina. In Argentina, they actually got a lot more ahead in prosecuting a lot of these violators of human rights. They got much more ahead than in Chile. And his rise to power is very perplexing, because in reality, it's very difficult to imagine how people would vote for somebody like that. He has serious mental health issues, but basically he's just a regular fascist. His propositions, he's basically privatized. He wants to close down the university system. He's actually closed down several programs, and the free university that was available prior is no longer available. I'm a healthcare and education worker, and he also has basically decimated the healthcare system from taking away the funding. And his libertarian style of governance, basically, he said that he wanted to get rid of all of the departments. And so maybe some of you here might find this kind of interesting, because there's several people within this government, the Congress people within this government, who also want to do the same thing. They want to do away with public programs, and they want to do away with funding, even doing away with Social Security, for example. So there's a massive hunger problem going on in Argentina. And with regards to Chile in particular, Milei has gone to the south of Chile and has been basically handing over the water rights to Israeli companies, Medecot, for example, and has been trying to attack Chile over the southern territory area. They've been verbal attacks for now, but there's been a lot of tension going on there. And we all know who he's working for. I mean, he almost peed in his pants from being so excited about meeting Trump, for example, you know? And his style of governance even goes beyond the neoliberal privatization scheme. It's a complete defunding of government, of any kind of semblance of responsibility for poor people, for people who are at a disadvantage, for workers. And basically, we need to really call them out on this, and call out Elon Musk as well, because he's also a supporter of Elon Musk. And one of the reasons why we say the techno-fascist is because there's a lot of tech companies in Silicon Valley that are participating in genocide right now in Palestine. And around the world. But one of the things that has been most notable and has come out in many news agencies is that there's a specific technology from the tech companies that has been developed called Where's Daddy? And Where's Daddy basically tracks people by their cell phones and tracks journalists in Gaza and waits until they get home to bomb their homes together with their entire families. And that is what Javier Milei is supporting. That is what these techno-fascists are supporting, as well as Zionists in Israel and the U.S.
And what we're saying is, stop the fascists, stop Milei. We don't want him in the United States, and the people of Argentina don't want him either. People of Argentina are organizing against him all over the country. There are strikes of teachers, there are strikes of public workers all over the country against this wannabe tin pot dictator. And that's who he is. So we're going to continue this campaign.
Olé! Olé, hola! Como a los nazis le va a pasar. A donde vayan los iremos a buscar.
Era la comida, mi ley. Es la comida de los pobres que te afanaste, ladrón. Libera la comida de los pobres.
Those were the voices of Bay Area community and labor organizations protesting the visit of Argentinian President Javier Milei. They rallied in San Jose, where he was supposed to speak, but he canceled his appearance. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Polina Vasiliev, Steve Seltzer, Akua Holt, J.R. Valre, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.